KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The cumulative effect here is a lot less access to vaccines, just making it much harder for Americans to get vaccinated.
From bird flu to COVID, the Trump administration's moves on vaccines all point in one direction.
For Thursday, May 29th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Coming up, the U.S. intends to aggressively revoke Chinese student visas. We'll look at the possible impact.
Really, best and brightest. Those kinds of students, I would guarantee you, would not really study abroad these days. They would just stay in China.
Also, a golfer who was legendary in her time but died in obscurity finally gets her due.
She was the roaring 20s. And I think that's what the It Girl comment stands out, is that nobody in sports represented this new age.
And what if solutions to some of the world's biggest problems could come from some of its smallest creatures?
Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Donald Trump's on-again, off-again tariffs are, for the moment, back on again. That's after a federal appeals court temporarily put on hold a ruling made yesterday by the U.S. Court of International Trade to block nearly all of Trump's tariffs. Latest action is an administrative stay asking companies that challenge the tariffs to present their arguments next week. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, meanwhile, said the courts need to stop blocking Trump's tariffs.
This administration is committed to fair trade, and we are striking the best deals for the American people, and anything that the courts do to get in the way, they both harms the American people in terms of trade and in terms of tariff revenue.
President Trump today called the Court of International Trade ruling wrong and politicized. Financial markets have been whipsawed by the constant changes in administration policy. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has sent his reorganization plan to Congress. He's making deep cuts, but says they're meant to make the State Department more agile, as we hear from NPR's Michelle Kellerman.
Secretary Rubio often complains about the bureaucracy at the State Department. Now he's giving Congress a look at his plan to streamline the org chart and cut staff drastically in some areas like human rights and democracy. He's putting more of an emphasis on regional bureaus and says in today's world, the State Department must move at the quote, speed of relevance. Democrats on Capitol Hill have argued that his cuts mean that the U.S. is ceding ground to U.S. adversaries, including China. The Trump administration has dismantled the lead U.S. aid agency, and Rubio is taking over what remains of USAID. There won't be cuts to passport and visa services, which are funded by fees. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
American and European nationalists and conservatives are in Hungary for the Conservative Political Action Conference, known as CPAC. In recent years, American conservatives have looked to Hungary as an aspirational model, though analysts say it's experienced an autocratic backslide. NPR's Arzu Rezvani has more.
Hungary is becoming a pariah state within the European Union for its effective ban on pride celebrations, a proposed law that would blacklist organizations that get foreign funding, and breaches of European laws that have prompted the EU to withhold billions of dollars. But American conservatives, like U.S. CPAC chair Matt Schlapp, praise Hungary's leader Viktor Orban for implementing Hungary First policies and for fighting against global institutions.
The EU wants to dictate to these countries how many migrants they take. And what Orban and the people of Hungary are saying is, no, we're going to determine what our immigration policy is.
Schlapp says he expects to see more of these conservative gatherings around the world in the years to come. Arzu Rezvani, NPR News, Budapest.
Stocks gained ground on Wall Street today. The Dow was up 117 points. The Nasdaq rose 74 points. The S&P gained 23 points. This is NPR. Defense lawyers representing former movie mogul Harvey Weinstein have begun presenting their witnesses at his sex crimes retrial in New York. What was still not clear is whether Weinstein will be taking the stand. The 73-year-old Weinstein is being retried on rape and sexual assault charges because New York's highest court overturned his 2020 conviction on procedural grounds. The Tony Awards and CBS announced today the original company of Hamilton will reunite for a special 10th anniversary performance of the broadcast this year. Jeff London says Hamilton was a juggernaut when it originally opened with a record-breaking 16 nominations and 11 wins.
The producers of the Tony Awards are not throwing away their shot.
I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot.
They're bringing back Lin-Manuel Miranda, Leslie Odom Jr., and the original cast of Hamilton to perform a number on this year's program. The musical will celebrate its 10th year on Broadway this August, and it still remains a top-grossing show every week. A once-in-a-generation success, no subsequent musical to open on Broadway has come close to replicating Hamilton's popularity. The Tonys will be broadcast on Sunday, June 8th. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
The number of Americans filing first-time jobless claims took a bump up last week, though for the most part, even with some global economic uncertainties, employers are holding on to their workers. The Labor Department says for the week ending May 24th, weekly applications were up by 14,000 to a seasonally adjusted 240,000. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The Trump administration has announced a flurry of big changes involving vaccines these last few days. The moves have triggered alarm and outrage among many public health experts, and they have raised fears and questions among many regular people. NPR health correspondent and lovely regular person, Rob Stein, is here to bring us up to date. Hi, Rob.
Hey there, Mary Louise.
Okay, start with COVID-19. Over the past week or so, the administration suddenly announced two big changes that could restrict access to COVID shots. What were they?
Yeah, it's been a real whirlwind. First, last week, federal health officials imposed new requirements on the COVID vaccines. They're demanding that vaccine companies conduct big new studies to once again prove the vaccines are safe and still effective. That will likely make it harder, if not impossible, for anyone to get the shots except for people who are at least 65 or have other health issues.
At least 65 or other health issues.
Yeah.
Okay, that's one. What's the second big change?
Then this week, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. dropped another bombshell. He removed the blanket recommendations that healthy children and healthy pregnant women routinely get immunized against COVID, again, likely making it much more difficult for healthy children and healthy pregnant women to get the shots. Federal officials argue both moves make sense at this point in the pandemic, you know, given how much immunity everybody has. And they argue they're prudent given what they say are ongoing questions about the safety of the shots, especially the mRNA vaccines. But, you know, I've been talking to lots of regular people who are pretty upset by these moves because they still really want to get the shots. And to public health and infectious disease experts who are, you know, outraged. They say billions of people have gotten the vaccines, proving they're safe and effective. Here's Dr. Ashish Jha, the dean of the Brown University School of Public Health.
The cumulative effect here is a lot less access to vaccines, just making it much harder for Americans to get vaccinated. And so I'm pretty worried about where we are.
Rob, that's the COVID vaccines. But then the Trump administration announced another decision involving a different kind of mRNA vaccine. What do we know about that?
Yeah, the Department of Health and Human Services revealed that the government had canceled a $766 million contract to develop an mRNA vaccine to protect people against flu viruses that could cause the next pandemic, including the bird flu virus. Instead, the government will use the money for other vaccine technologies, but many experts consider those technologies to be outdated.
And what is the broader concern here?
Well, you know, these are just the latest steps that Kennedy has taken that affect vaccines, especially the mRNA vaccines. So many public health experts worry that this is part of an overall strategy to just undermine public confidence and the use of the vaccines. They point to the measles outbreak that's currently underway and upticks in other childhood diseases like, you know, whooping cough as evidence of the impact we're already seeing. Here's Dr. Paul Offit from the University of Pennsylvania.
It's a war on vaccines, it's a war on children, and I think that RFK Jr. is exactly what he has been for the last 20 years, which is a virulent anti-vaccine activist, science denialist, and conspiracy theorist.
Now, I reached out to the federal government about all this, but never heard back. But I should say that some outside experts I talked to do agree with the government's rationale for at least some of these decisions.
NPR health correspondent Rob Stein, thanks.
You bet, Mary Louise. You're a lovely person yourself.
Thank you.
It's almost Pride Month, and the political climate has many drag performers worried about safety. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports one group has released guidelines to help people stay safe this June and beyond.
Freddie Hercury is a drag king in Buffalo, New York. They channel the spirit of Queen's charismatic frontman, Freddie Mercury, on stage, as in this performance captured on Facebook.
I want to break free.
Pride is a busy time and not always easy. Last year, Hercury received a bomb threat on Facebook ahead of a gig in Niagara Falls.
I was like, okay, well, that doesn't make me feel great.
Hercury had just heard about a new network of drag performers and their allies whose aim it is to help people in just these situations. This group is called Committee, spelled with a Q, not a C. Hercury reached out to them.
They were immediately responsive and really just kind of walked me through the process of how I wanted to handle it.
Hercury reported the threat to the FBI. The gig went ahead with no incident. Committee has dispensed a lot of security advice to drag artists over the past year and has now, with help from lawyers and other experts, distilled it into the Drag Defense Handbook.
This handbook is a collaborative collection of experiences from drag artists across the country who have experienced hatred or threat and what they've done to stand up and make these safe spaces.
Drag performer Veranda Lanai is based in Cleveland and helped put together the handbook. It contains best practices for dealing with everything from online doxing to bomb attacks. Lanai herself has been a target. A man from a neo-Nazi group threw a Molotov cocktail into a church to prevent her from leading a drag queen story hour in 2023. No one was hurt. The culprit admitted he wanted to, quote, protect children. He was arrested and sentenced to 18 years in prison.
There are steps to be had, making sure that you screen capture everything, make sure everything is documented, making sure you have security around you, knowing your First Amendment protections.
According to the LGBTQ advocacy nonprofit GLAAD, there have been more than 80 attacks, both online and physical, specifically targeting drag performers in the US over the past year. The number is actually a big drop from the previous year, less than half. In a statement, the organization attributed the decline in part to the drag community getting smarter about safety and security. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
What if solutions to some of the planet's biggest problems could be found inside some of its smallest creatures? That is the bet a team of researchers is making, and it's led them to places both remote and, lately, rather familiar. Here's NPR's Ari Daniel.
There are spots where the Earth's inner rumblings burble to the surface, like Manitou Springs in central Colorado. At this particular well, every few seconds, a burst of water surges out of a narrow pipe, splashing into a concrete basin. So you can drink from this?
Yes, you can.
Doug Edmondson heads the Mineral Springs Foundation.
Tastes like iron. If you're a vampire, you'd be a fan.
Here above ground, that iron rusts, and it's dyed part of the basin a bright orange, which James Henriksen, an environmental microbiologist at Colorado State University, is now sampling.
Whenever I see that color, I look very carefully because sometimes it's not chemistry that's forming that rust, it's biology. An entire world of unexplored and undiscovered microbes.
Microbes teeming invisibly and improbably in these colorful puddles. Braden Tierney is looking on as well. He's a microbiologist at Harvard Medical School who says that microbes thrive in some of the most extreme places imaginable that are, say, high pressure or super cold or really salty.
Microbes are nature's alchemists. So they are capable of taking just about any chemical and turning it into something else to survive.
Several years back, Tierney began wondering whether he could harness these abilities of microbes somehow. So he co-founded a nonprofit called the Two Frontiers Project to search for microorganisms that could help solve some of our big problems.
We travel to sites all around the world where there is microbial life, we think, living that's going to be useful for things like carbon capture or helping corals or improving agriculture.
The hunt has taken the team to reefs in the Red Sea, springs across Colorado like this one, and volcanic vents off Sicily, where they found a microbe that excels at sucking CO2 out of the air better than other carbon-fixing microbes they know of. And now the team suspects they may not need to travel quite so far to find other similarly useful organisms. They've now turned their attention to our homes.
I mean, you're running slimes and goobs everywhere in my profession.
Chris Buret worked in facilities maintenance for years, including in Colorado, and he says it's inevitable that pipes clog and drip pans fill with snotty goo, often the telltale accumulation of microbes.
I would just refer to it as sludge, probably.
But one person's sludge is another person's startup. James Henriksen says this sludge in the nooks and crannies of our homes may well contain habitats teeming with interesting microbial life.
Weird, slimy things in shower heads, stuff growing in dishwashers, hot water heaters. They're really strange environments.
And potentially extreme environments around our homes and under our noses that have pressured microbes into finding ways of grabbing carbon to grow and survive. In other words, maybe something that holds a secret to reducing CO2 levels is your roommate.
Please come in.
Rebecca Espinoza is among the citizen scientists offering up samples from their homes.
So we're going downstairs.
She lives in Loveland, Colorado, and Braden Tierney has come to pay her a visit today.
Okay, this is cool.
He samples a shower head and a drain in the basement.
It looks really gross.
But to a microbiologist, it's very exciting.
Tierney's team is reaching out to homeowners nationwide, and they've already received 47 curious snots and brews. As with all their samples, the researchers will sequence the DNA to census the microbes and determine whether any new species might be useful to us.
Microbes are amazing at what they do, but can we get their processes into a system that's economically competitive, that we can scale and deploy?
Lisa Stein is a climate change microbiologist at the University of Alberta. She says that scientists have bioprospected for novel microorganisms for decades, but she adds that microbes are constantly evolving, and she hasn't seen anyone sample in the home like this before.
That's pretty innovative right there.
Still, the best way to bring down CO2 levels probably won't be found in your shower head, but by reducing emissions. In the meantime, the hunt for a microbial marvel that can bail us out of our many messes continues. Ari Daniel, NPR News.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The U.S. Supreme Court sharply narrowed the scope of a key environmental statute today. The ruling makes it easier to win approval for highways, bridges, pipelines, wind farms, and other infrastructure projects. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg has this report.
The National Environmental Policy Act, known as NEPA, is considered the nation's premier law on the environment because it sets up a regulatory regime under which the federal government seeks information from a wide array of agencies about what the impact of a proposed infrastructure project would be before it's built. In today's case, the issue was the proposed building of an 88-mile stretch of railroad that would connect Utah's oil-rich Uinta Basin to the National Freight Rail Network. Once built, the new rail lines would facilitate the transportation of crude oil to refineries in Texas and Louisiana along the Gulf Coast. In carrying out the review, the U.S. Surface Transportation Board sought input from other agencies, prepared a 3,600-page report, and approved the railroad project after concluding that its transportation and economic benefits outweighed the negative impact on the environment. The U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. subsequently ruled that the board had violated NEPA by failing to consider the environmental effects from oil drilling and production, referred to as upstream, and oil refining and distribution, known as downstream. Today, however, the Supreme Court reversed that ruling and in so doing dramatically limited the 1970 law. The vote was unanimous, though the court's three liberals would not have gone as far. The court's conservatives, however, took a major whack at the NEPA statute. Harvard Law Professor Richard Lazarus is one of the nation's leading experts on the law.
They did a major cutback on it. They said categorically nothing upstream and downstream. Right or wrong, that's not been NEPA law for 50 years.
Writing for the court majority, Justice Brett Kavanaugh said that the courts should defer to agency determinations about where to draw the line when considering environmental effects as long as agency choices, quote, fall within a broad zone of reasonableness. Unlike other environmental laws, he said, NEPA is a purely procedural statute meant to be a cross-check, not a roadblock. Kavanaugh framed his opinion as a judicial correction to NEPA, pointing to what he called delay after delay on multiple projects that sometimes has, quote, bordered on the Kafkaesque. The goal of the law, he said, is to inform projects, not hamstring them. But Professor Lazarus says the Kavanaugh opinion reads less like a judicial correction and more like a legislative policy initiative.
He goes on this tirade where he talks about how awful NEPA has been, and how it stopped all these things, how it's cost jobs, and there's no citation. He's made it up. It's complete policy argument.
At the same time, though, Lazarus concedes there's been consistent pushback against NEPA over the years, both at the court and in Congress. He notes, for instance, that Congress in 2023, during the Biden administration, took steps to limit some of the NEPA review. Indeed, he says, some environmental groups have also endorsed speeding up the process.
Some of the national groups who want those transmission grids built and those windmills up and those solar panel huge facilities built. So NEPA has created that tension.
But many environmental groups were dismayed by today's decision. Earth Justice called the decision an invitation to the Trump administration to, quote, ignore environmental concerns as it tries to promote fossil fuels, kill off renewable energy, and destroy sensible pollution requirements. Conversely, A large array of mining, oil, lumber, real estate, and other interests were thrilled by the court's decision today. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
A woman who was a golf legend in her time, but who died in obscurity, will get her due in a memorial service this week. Miriam Burns shared headlines with baseball slugger Babe Ruth, also with heavyweight boxer Jack Dempsey, but she was buried years later in an unmarked grave in Kansas City. Reporter Greg Eklund has more details about her life.
Ain't she sweet? See her coming down the street.
In 1927, Ain't She Sweet was all the rage, and the song fit Miriam Burns. The snappy 23-year-old Kansas City golfer dazzled the Long Island, New York crowd. It was there where she won the U.S. Women's Amateur Golf Championship. To some, she was Mrs. Horn, a recently divorced mother of an infant son at the time. But most of the attention centered around her game, colorful outfits, and no-holds-barred personality.
It was noted that she smoked like a chimney during her rounds. She chewed gum. She was not above an occasional profanity.
That's former Sports Illustrated magazine golf writer John Garrity. He says it was O.B. Keeler, a 1920s influential golf writer, who labeled Burns the it girl of women's golf.
She was the roaring 20s. And I think that's what the it girl comment stands out, is that nobody in sports represented this new age more than Miriam Burns.
That bygone notoriety is one of the reasons Ashley Tyson of Miami, Florida, the great-granddaughter of Miriam Burns, is in Kansas City for the graveside memorial service. Tyson is no golfer, but says she has a visceral sense of Miriam Burns.
Hearing about her chain smoking and like cracking jokes on the golf course, I'm just like, that sounds like somebody I am related to for sure.
Just 24 years after her national title, Burns died without fanfare. She had married a second time and retired from golf in 1930 following the 1929 stock market crash and when no women's professional tour existed. Her son, Kenneth, born from her first marriage, was alive when Burns died of pneumonia in 1951, and Tyson wonders why her grandfather couldn't have helped with a more dignified burial for his mother.
I'm so curious, and I don't know if I really want to know the answer to this, but it's about my great-grandmother, but also about her relationship with my grandfather and why we don't have those ties.
Tyson says very little is known about the emotional connections or the lack of them between Burns and the rest of her family.
It gives me a little bit of pain and sadness because I just feel like there's probably a lot of hurt and suffering there, and I don't know why.
Kansas City historian Bruce Matthews discovered that a local funeral home had actually placed Miriam Burns' remains next to the marked grave of her father. Standing near the gravesites, he explains.
The family never knew about it after that, and she was kind of lost. Nobody had any records of her until we started looking for her and found out that she was buried here.
Now the family and others who've become fans of the golfer, once a celebrity and until now long forgotten, will pay tribute. Among them will be Kansas City's most recognizable golfer, Tom Watson. And now in her final resting place, Miriam Burns will have a headstone graced with her name. For NPR News, I'm Greg Eklund in Kansas City.
This is NPR News.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR's Morning Edition, which reminds you of the power of one human voice. You turn on the radio some morning, or your device, and you're listening to Morning Edition, and you hear one person telling a story from the other side of the world or from a neighborhood near you, and that voice brings you understanding of the news. Listen to Morning Edition every day.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Coming up, Elon Musk says he's exiting Washington.
Not before criticizing Trump's big, beautiful bill on his way out the door.
I was, like, disappointed to see the massive spending bill, frankly, which increases the budget deficit, not just decrease it, and undermines the work that the Doge team is doing.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer says President Trump would be breaking a promise he made if he pardons two men who were convicted of orchestrating a violent scheme to kidnap her. From Michigan Public Radio, Rick Pluta reports.
The Republican president has said he's considering pardons for the two men who are serving federal prison terms for a plot that included staking out the Democratic governor's vacation home and using incendiary devices to get past security. Governor Whitmer says the president told her just the opposite last month in a White House meeting.
He asked me how I'd feel about this, and I said I think it'd be the wrong decision. I would oppose it. He said, okay, I'll drop it.
Whitmer says a pardon would send a dangerous message about the consequences of violence against public servants. She noted that she publicly condemned violence against public officials following an assassination attempt on Trump last year. For NPR News, I'm Rick Pluta.
Harvard graduates are celebrating commencement today at a pivotal time for the university that's been under increasing threat by the Trump administration. Students cheered speakers who stressed the importance of maintaining a diverse and international student body. After congratulating class of 2025, speaker and infectious disease expert Dr. Abraham Verghese called it an unprecedented time for Harvard.
In this institution's almost four-century existence, there has probably never been more attention focused on you than in these last few months, weeks, days. Honestly, in coming to your campus, I feel very much like a medieval messenger who had to sneak through the encircling forces and slip into your besieged community.
The Trump administration has canceled more than $2.5 billion in federal research grants to Harvard. This is NPR. Prosecutors in Florida plan to retry two prisoners on death row after former President Biden reduced their federal sentences. As George Hale of member station WFIU reports.
Ricardo Sanchez Jr. and Daniel Troya were among 37 men whose federal death sentences Biden commuted to life last year. Now Florida State Attorney Tom Bechtel says he wants to try them in state court and seek the death penalty again.
The former administration took it upon themselves to override the will of the people.
Capital defense attorney Maria De Liberato says the move is a waste of resources as both men are already serving life sentences.
And now he just ripped the Band-Aid off and started that all over again. That doesn't make any sense.
In January, President Trump told U.S. justice officials to help state prosecutors retry Biden clemency recipients when possible. For NPR News, I'm George Hale.
A federal appeals court has granted the Trump administration a win on tariffs for now, granting a reprieve just one day after the Court of International Trade ruled the president exceeded his authority with the sweeping import taxes. Earlier today, a second federal court blocked Trump's authority to unilaterally impose tariffs on foreign-made products coming into the U.S., but a judge also paused his ruling for 2 weeks, giving the White House time to appeal the decision. The ongoing uncertainty has roiled financial markets and consumers. I'm Duane Brown. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Mathnasium. Whether students are ahead of the curve or need extra support, Mathnasium's goal is to build confidence through personalized math instruction. Learn more at mathnasium.com. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The U.S. says it is going to aggressively revoke visas of Chinese students and researchers in the U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says those with connections to China's ruling Communist Party, or those who study in what he termed critical fields, could see their visas terminated. NPR's Emily Fang is here in the studio to help us understand what this could mean. Hey, Emily.
Hi, Ari.
Let's start with the language Secretary Rubio used. Do you know what counts as a substantial connection to the Communist Party or what the U.S. considers a critical field that might lead a student's visa to be revoked?
No, and these are quite vague. Depending on how broadly these terms are defined, it could impact nearly all of the 280,000 or so Chinese and Hong Kong students who are in the U.S. They range from people who are studying at the high school level to postdoctoral researchers. And Trump's team has been trying for a while, actually, to stop Chinese students from coming to the U.S. And the argument that they make is one of national security, that the students in China are at risk because they could ultimately use their American education in the U.S. to strengthen China. And this is not the first time they've tried to control the numbers coming here. Back during his first term, Trump's team reportedly was even mulling a blanket ban on Chinese students, though they didn't go through with that.
Is there evidence that these nearly 300,000 people may be a national security threat to the U.S.?
So this is what we know. We know China does have a track record of stealing intellectual property from the U.S. We know they try to poach American talent. But the U.S. already screens Chinese students for any military and intelligence links, and the overwhelming consensus among people who study U.S.-China tech competition that I've been speaking to has been that the benefits of attracting these Chinese-born researchers and students far outweighs the risks. One of these people is Cole McFaul. He's a research analyst at CSET. This is a research organization at Georgetown University. And he points out U.S. tech innovation has really drawn from Chinese talent who come to the U.S. and they stay in the U.S.
And that's a really important force multiplier for the United States. I see that as America's number one advantage in our kind of tech competition with China. That's something that China is not able to do, right?
As in, they're not able to attract foreign talent like the U.S. The vast majority of Chinese students, after they graduate, stay in the U.S., working at U.S. companies, becoming professors at U.S. universities, according to CSET. And so the U.S. gets to retain that talent, McFaul argues, rather than China.
What are you hearing today from students and from universities about the impact this could have?
It is having a huge ripple effect. People are extremely fearful. And that's because so much of our basic scientific research, mostly at universities, relies on work from graduate and postdoc students. Universities need more and more of these researchers, and a lot of them come from China. So American higher education has been hit already by billions of dollars in federal research funding that's been cut, and now, potentially, they're going to lose a good chunk of their research talent, too. And for the U.S., there's a longer-term implication. As a top-tier country for education, you know, American higher education has long been revered, like utterly venerated in China, even when bilateral relations were fraught. And education is a huge source of American soft power, but that soft power is perhaps not as attractive as before. I spoke to Yingying Ma about this. She's a sociology professor at Syracuse University, and she says more restrictive immigration policies, China's own universities, which are becoming stronger, means fewer Chinese students want to come to the U.S. now.
Really, best and brightest. Those kinds of students, I would guarantee you, would not really study abroad these days. They would just stay in China.
Education industry groups calculate that American soft power actually creates billions of dollars a year in revenue for universities, jobs, research patents. And all of that is because of international students, including those from China, who have been coming to the U.S.
NPR's Emily Fang, thank you.
Thanks, Ari.
Filmmaker Wes Anderson is known for movies that are whimsical, artificial, jewel box-like, and to his fans, very funny. They are also pointed critiques, whether he is spoofing 1930s decadence in Grand Budapest Hotel or family dysfunction in The Royal Tenenbaums. Anderson's latest comedy is The Phoenician Scheme. Critic Bob Mondello says it is about a gazillionaire who becomes slightly conflicted about making one last financial killing.
We begin on a low-altitude flight. A 1950s robber baron in a pinstripe suit is reading a thick nonfiction book as an explosion takes out the back half of his private plane. Cut to a crash site where he lies amid smoldering wreckage as a newscaster fills in details.
At this moment, rescue workers are laboring to recover and identify the remains of Zsa Zsa Korda, international businessman, maverick in the fields of armaments and aviation, among the richest men in Europe.
Korda, looking annoyed, sits up in the wreckage.
This was Korda's sixth recorded airplane crash.
His sixth near assassination.
He is survived by 10 children, 9 boys, 1 nun, his daughter Liesl.
While not dead, this brush with death has him uncharacteristically thinking about those survivors. Usually, he's just thinking business.
Korda Land and Sea Phoenician Infrastructure Scheme. My most important project of my lifetime.
A project that will require cash infusions, for which he turns to loyal investors who are hell-bent on
disrupting, obstructing, impeding, crippling Korda's enterprise in any manner possible.
So he spends a lot of time in meetings with folks like money men Tom Hanks and Bryan Cranston.
Call it heads.
Who negotiate
heads
while playing basketball. Korda, played brusquely by Benicio del Toro, enjoys the art of the deal, but 6 assassination attempts have sobered even him. So he summons his daughter, a nun in training, who arrives in a habit.
I've appointed you sole heir to my estate.
And makes clear she's not in the habit.
Which you may come into sooner rather than later.
Of just going along.
Why?
Why what?
Why sooner rather than later, since you survived again? And why am I sole heir to your estate? You have 8 sons at last count.
9 sons.
9 sons. What about them?
They're not my heirs.
Why not?
I have my reasons.
Which are what?
My reasons? I'm not saying.
Liesl, played by Mia Threapleton, with a sort of comic deadpan her mother Kate Winslet has patented in other films, agrees to a trial period with this monstrous father of whom she disapproves. Figuring she's about to give up all her worldly possessions anyway, she agrees to learn how he scams allies, cheats rivals, and manipulates markets.
I'm doing a strategy. Listen carefully.
And filmmaker Wes Anderson brings the rest of us along with visuals that are precious, symmetrical, and exquisite, plus cameos by the likes of Scarlett Johansson as Korda's second cousin Hilda.
Who shot you?
Kara's from out of town. Help yourself to a hand grenade.
You're very kind.
And Michael Cera.
Could you imagine falling in love with a man like me, by the way, hypothetically?
You're drunk on 3 beers.
Who, when he's not wooing the film's nun in training, is discovering bombs on Korda's plane.
Is this supposed to be here? It was under the lunch trolley.
Oh, dear.
How much time does this have?
18 minutes.
Perfectly fine. We land in 10.
Korda is modeled on the 19th century industrialists, Rockefellers, Carnegies, Vanderbilts, who built oil, steel, and railroad monopolies through cutthroat business practices, but it's hard not to think of the unchecked and seemingly uncheckable power of contemporary billionaires when Korda explains why, say, he doesn't bother with having a passport.
Normal people want the basic human rights that accompany citizenship in any sovereign nation. I don't. My legal residence is a shack in Portugal. My official domicile is a hut on the Black Sea. I don't live anywhere. I'm not a citizen at all. I don't need my human rights.
That is decently chilling and makes the character's discovery that he actually has a heart feel like a clarion call to robber barons of every stripe. Now, if they could just be persuaded to see the Phoenician scheme. I'm Bob Mondello.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. A U.S.-backed group says it has delivered more than 1.8 million meals to Palestinians in its first 3 days operating in Gaza. The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation began distributing food parcels in a few sites in the south of the territory after Israel lifted its nearly 3-month blockade. The UN and aid groups say Israel's new system is inadequate and, quote, a weaponization of aid at a time of extreme hunger there. As NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi reports, some civilians are also describing chaos at the sites.
Iyad Al-Jalous heard that the new system was starting to hand out boxes of food. After nearly 3 months of Israel's total blockade of aid, it was hopeful news. NPR producer Ahmed Abu Hamda spoke to Jalous by phone. He's sheltering in the southern city of Khan Yunis. I have nothing to eat, Jalous says. I was hoping that one of the boxes could tide us over for a few days. The 55-year-old is a father of eight. Before the war, he was a computer programmer. His whole family now sleeps in one room in a relative's house. The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, or GHF, set up a distribution site about 7 miles away from there. GHF is the new U.S.-backed organization that Israel is allowing to handle nearly all food distribution in Gaza. Yet they only distribute food in Gaza South. GHF hasn't publicly disclosed where their funding is from and didn't respond to an NPR inquiry. Jalous says early this morning he and his brother set out for one of the three sites. We set our alarms for 6 a.m. to get going and put our trust in God. He says as he got closer, he heard shots being fired. He describes an incredible scene. Mobs, people stomping over each other and people gasping for breath. He says it was chaos. There were no lists of names or IDs, he says. He thought it would be more organized. People were grabbing as many boxes as they could, he says. Witnesses in the first 2 days of operations reported shots fired and dozens of injuries. In a press statement today, GHF said any reports of chaos was, quote, misinformation. Yet later, GHF reported warning shots and smoke were used at one site to disperse a crowd. NPR spoke to a second person at another GHF site, 39-year-old Ala Abu Yas. They opened the gates and you could even take 10 boxes, Abu Yas says. Israel says Hamas steals aid. It says the new system will stop that and will weaken the militant group's control in Gaza. The United Nations denies that there has been widespread diversion of aid. Abu Yas says the surging crowd scared him. Just as I turned away, that's when the fence collapsed, he says. Abu Yas walked away empty-handed, just like father of eight Iyad Jalous. Jalous says his kids believed the boxes had treats. They heard that there were chocolates and ramen noodles. Jalous says he had to break their hearts. He had nothing. His family keeps asking him, are you going back again tomorrow? I go hungry, I come back hungry, he says. Where am I supposed to get the energy to keep making the trip? Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Elon Musk says he's leaving the federal government behind. The richest man in the world took a chainsaw to government programs in the last few months as head of the White House initiative known as the Department of Government Efficiency. Those cuts have been controversial, and they've also been at the center of lawsuits. Musk says the work of DOGE will continue even after he returns to his corporate jobs. NPR's Stephen Fowler and Bobby Allen have covered the work of DOGE, and they're here to talk about Elon Musk's impact on Washington and what comes next. Good to have you both here.
Hey, Ari.
Hey there.
Elon Musk was brought on as a time-limited special government employee. He says his time is up, and that's why he's leaving. Stephen, is it that simple?
Well, normally special government employees have this 130-day time limit. Tomorrow would be 130 days from when Musk started and Trump took office, if you assume Musk was working every day on DOGE. Also, Musk technically, and according to the White House legally, was never actually in charge of DOGE, so he probably could have gone a lot longer. But a lot of his comments and DOGE's actions have been unpopular. So there's also the reality that Musk's continued association with the Trump administration and Republican policies could serve as a political albatross coming up in the midterm election cycle. And Elon Musk is a businessman, not a politician, so this special government employee rules provides a convenient segue out of federal government work in a way that a politician can't.
As a businessman, he leads several companies, including SpaceX and Tesla. Bobby, how did Musk's work at the White House affect his business empire?
Yeah, Tesla, which is Musk's main source of wealth, was really hurt by Musk's work in the Trump administration. One analyst even called the impact on Tesla as an unprecedented brand destruction. And there was serious backlash, right? Tesla owners sold their cars. Some Tesla storefronts were vandalized. The car just became a symbol of the havoc Musk was overseeing in the White House. And in the first quarter of the year, Tesla's profits dropped 71% compared to a year ago. There were reports that Tesla's board of directors was starting to look for a Musk replacement. It was getting pretty bad for him. The Tesla board has since eased off that, but many longtime observers of Musk say this was one of his biggest surprises in the DOGE work, that Tesla would become politicized and it would drag the company down. Now, he's trying to get Tesla investors excited by promoting the launch of what he's calling a robo-taxi, a self-driving car service that he claims will launch next month in Austin. And in a bunch of recent interviews, he's taking every opportunity he can, Ari, to say he can now focus on Tesla since DOGE is behind him.
All right, but before we leave DOGE behind, let's go back a bit. During the campaign and early in the administration, Elon Musk and Donald Trump were side by side all the time. It was like a buddy movie. That relationship seems to be souring too. What have you seen, Stephen?
Well, there's been some distance growing between the two. The further into this year we've gotten and the further their priorities have split. Here's an interview clip from CBS that was released this week where Musk criticized Trump's proposed One Big Beautiful Bill that passed the House.
You know, I was like disappointed to see the massive spending bill, frankly, which increases the budget deficit, not just decrease it, and undermines the work that the DOGE team is doing.
Now, at a White House press briefing today, Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt said that Trump thanks Musk for getting DOGE off of the ground and the efforts to cut waste, fraud, and abuse will continue. But Ari, there really hasn't been much evidence of significant waste, fraud, and abuse uncovered. I mean, DOGE has constantly oversold its savings claims, they've made errors, and a lot of times just got things wrong about how government works. So in many ways, Musk's core goals about DOGE haven't really been met.
And then there are the lawsuits. Some court rulings have blocked Elon Musk's moves to reduce the size of government. Bobby, where do the legal challenges stand?
Yeah, there have been quite a few. At last count, at least 20 different lawsuits challenging both Musk's role and DOGE's legal ability to upend the federal government. The suits are at various stages, but just this week, a federal judge advanced one of the suits alleging Musk and DOGE were given powers over the U.S. government that exceeded Musk's legal authority. Then there are data privacy concerns, right? A big mission of DOGE has been to knock down data silos and to pull data on federal employees and American taxpayers, you know, into one big system. And in the process, critics say norms and in some cases laws appear to have been trampled on in an effort to, you know, build this master database. Musk has also said he's been really taken aback by just how cumbersome and old-fashioned some government systems are. But experts say in some cases, like with national security material, the difficulty in sharing is kind of the point.
Musk's social media announcement says, quote, "The DOGE mission will only strengthen over time as it becomes a way of life throughout the government." Is that true?
Well, many of the people brought into these agencies to make changes are still going to be there because they're federal employees still carrying out the DOGE agenda, which is Trump's agenda if the lawsuits don't knock things down.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think DOGE's work without Musk will mean that DOGE will be less high profile, maybe a bit less chaotic, but I think it's fair to say that DOGE isn't going away anytime soon.
NPR's Bobby Allen and Stephen Fowler, thank you.
Thanks, Ari.
Thank you.
That is the sound of a collapsing glacier roaring down a mountainside in the Swiss Alps yesterday. It wiped out one village in its path. The destruction it caused surprised officials who blamed climate change. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley tells us more.
Videos of the Birsch Glacier hurtling down the mountainside went viral Wednesday afternoon right after the natural disaster struck. A dark cloud of rock and ice rose up, obscuring the mountainscape. A nearly mile-long strip of ice, rock, and mud, some 200 yards wide, now covers the village of Blatten and its valley.
What happened is catastrophic. It's the worst-case scenario.
That's Christophe Lambiel, a specialist in high mountain geology and glaciers with the University of Lausanne. He told RTS Swiss Television that despite preparation, no one thought it would be so dramatic. Scientists knew something was coming. For weeks, boulders had been falling off a mountain face onto the glacier, putting weight and pressure on it. Some 3 million cubic yards of rocks and boulders piled up on it in recent years. But despite the violence of the landslide, only one person is missing. That's because Blatten's 300 residents were evacuated more than a week ago.
Alors que la montagne continue de s'effondrer, cette image a fait le tour du monde.
And not just people. This Swiss TV special shows some of Blatten's cows being airlifted out by helicopter. The Birsch Glacier was unique, says geologist Lambiel. While other glaciers are receding, this glacier was advancing due to the pressure and weight of the rock fall. He told Swiss TV that was linked to climate change.
The rock face was unstable because of the melting permafrost. The permafrost has warmed 1 degree in the last 10 years.
At a press conference just after the glacier's collapse, shocked Swiss officials spoke. Nature is stronger than human beings, and no one knows this more than mountain people, said Environment Minister Albert Rosti. But what happened was the worst we could have imagined. Matthias Belwald is the mayor of Blatten. He offered words of encouragement. The village is under the gravel, but we're alive and we're going to get back up, he said. In solidarity, everything is possible. Blatten has a future. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens for gardens and landscapes at garden centers nationwide. ProvenWinnersColorChoice.com/NPR. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. From Progressive Insurance, working to help protect small businesses and the owners that run them, offering customizable coverages to salons, accounting firms, tradespeople, and more. Learn more at ProgressiveCommercial.com.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
My lovely Elizabeth. I am deeply worried at heart. I'm deeply worried at heart, 'cause the girl I love so well, my friend has emerged from me. Now I scarcely know what to do, but to hang my head and cry for my lovely Isabel.